Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to the Early Morning Sunday Show, and we've reached our conscious consumer spot with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from the Economics and Finance Desk of the Jamiatul Ulama South Africa. We have some interesting topics that we'll be discussing today, and remember, if you'd like to call in, the number is 011-854-1548, or maybe you'd prefer to send us a message on something that you'd like to question or have a suggestion on, then you can do that on 084-030-9955. I'll repeat both numbers for you. If you'd like to call in, the number 011-854-1548, or if you'd like to text us or WhatsApp, then you can try 084-030-9955. Mufti, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show this morning.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Afanisa, and all the listeners of Radio Islam International. JazakAllah for having me once again.
Well, some interesting questions that we have today, or as it's, say, topics of discussion. The first one is that some consumers are questioning the behavior-inducing practices of loyalty programs. Tell us about that.
No, but they're not taking it away from loyalty programs that they induce our behavior, you know, in terms of acting in a specific way with our resources and our commercial activity. So just the mere fact that we know that we're going to get some reward or some kind of accumulation of points which equate a cash value or some kind of gain at the end of the road or end of the tunnel, so as they say, we find that our behavior is conditioned by many of these loyalty programs. This week, however, we saw a very disturbing, rather disturbing aspect of loyalty programs where some of these, with specific reference to clicks, they put out a notice that you need to use your points before you lose them. What was disturbing to many consumers is that there was this warning of use before you lose, but there was no mention of when do those points expire. Obviously, as a consumer, you're driven to just act before it's too late and capitalize on your gains that you've made thus far. And so you go to the store, you make your purchases, you try to use your points, and you'll end up spending more than you actually planned to spend when you left your home. So it does tend to be the case, and these kind of behavior-inducing practices are likely to gain more traction in the coming months or even years as we go along. So that's one that came about. The other is the aspect of many consumers not taking into account that together with loyalty points that are accrued, being having some kind of expiry date attached to them, many a time even gift cards, even if one doesn't subscribe to any loyalty program per se, but maybe in receipt of a gift card, even the gift card can possibly expire. And it is important for consumers to know or take into consideration those kind of deadlines when it comes to exercising those benefits that you've either accrued or earned by virtue of your spending or even received as a gift from someone. So those are just a few cautionary words regarding these loyalty programs and something for ordinary consumers to be wary and conscious of.
Yeah, that's quite true. I think we discussed the gift cards before, the expiry date on some of these things. Talking about behavior induced, I saw, I think recently the adverts for, I think it's Discovery, or one of the banks where they've got quite a few of the sporting personalities, I think it's Discovery, talking about behavior banking or behavior medically. I'm not sure. I can't remember because I just kind of like saw it in passing, so I'm not really sure. But it said the first behavioral bank, I think it was. And I think it was Discovery because I remember seeing quite a few of the sporting personalities. It was Discovery Bank, according to our kind engineer. What do you think about that? Because doesn't it fall under the same sort of category of, changing the way we behave with regards to our banking now because of what's being offered?
You see, ultimately, what you're seeing now is the result of the past 10 years of loyalty programs being around. Because if you analyze it, what loyalty programs are geared towards achieving is the accumulation of data regarding a consumer, and that data is eventually processed through what we call in this day and age big data. It is processed to predict future behavior. So that's the whole, the long and short of any loyalty program, whether it's air tickets or at your local supermarket, whatever it is, it's all about accumulating data about yourself as a consumer so that your behavior can be predicted into the future. So this is what's now happening with banks and all of those other entities that you mentioned in there, where your past data is about to predict what you can do for the, what you are likely to do in the future. So if you look at an individual consumer, just the frequency with which someone maybe buys oil, let's say you buy oil just before the month of Ramadan, and that simple piece of data is reflected consistently throughout your profile of purchasing from your supermarket. It already means that your behavior is so predictable for the future that come Ramadan, you are likely to purchase so-and-so quantities of oil and maybe other commodities. So this is the long and short of loyalty programs. It's about predicting the consumer's behavior for the future. And the same can probably happen with money and management of a banking profile. The more a person utilizes a loyalty scheme in the context of banking, the behavior of the individual consumer can be predicted for the future. And we can almost, if you just take the example of saving pattern, maybe if that saving pattern is reflected on your loyalty profile, it points towards the possibility of eventually embarking on an investment. So suddenly, before long, the consumer will start seeing advertising or products more for the individual who is able to invest. So the same individual who maybe for the past 10 years could not invest, was saving all along, suddenly you find he's able to, he's promoted with an idea of investing and hence you fall for it. And that's fairly predictable because of your behavior of saving that prompts your interest in something, an avenue of investment.
I don't know, for me that's a scary thought. It just adds on a layer to the fact that we human beings have become very much that term that's bandied about quite often these days, sheeple. We just seem to be more predictable and easier led.
Yes, definitely. And this is precisely what is resulting in a very new form of capitalism, where they're calling it surveillance capitalism. It's a form of it's redefining the whole concept of ownership, because for you and I, we perceive ourselves as owners of our mobile devices. But if you look at what our mobile devices are doing, it's accumulating data regarding ourselves. And over time, surveillance capitalism basically means that you and I don't actually own our item. We don't actually own their phone, because in time to come, if there aren't bug fixes, if there aren't updates to that device or even that system that's running the device, ultimately, what it means is that it's beyond your use. You can't use it. So although you call yourself the owner of the item, you're so dependent on someone else to provide these updates and bug fixes and so forth, that if it's not provided, you're actually not the owner of your item anymore. It's of no use. You just have to throw it away. So you don't really own anything. And your behavior, even what you own, is suddenly in someone else's hands.
All right, it makes me go back to Animal Farm. I think that book comes to mind every time you look at the world today. Somehow or the other, you can pick up little things that are mentioned in the book that are taught to us, and it just seems to be sort of making itself felt in society these days.
Yes, definitely. I think that the book definitely bears a great lesson for many in terms of what we're seeing now happening. I just want to add one important point. When it comes to many people who become fazed or easily driven by technology to achieve outcomes, it should be borne in mind that while these tools are there and meant to simplify our lives, we should always bear in mind that the more technology-driven we become, the more we expose ourselves and become predictable to in terms of behavior for the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about that, I think also there's a lot of these, I don't know if I can call them conspiracy theories, but there's all this talk of being controlled constantly by, the upper level of, or the upper crust, or the 1% of society that's sitting with the wealth in the world today, and that they have basically enslaved us mentally. with all of these things that we're doing, because we don't really pay attention to some of the more important things that we should be paying attention to, and instead our focus is elsewhere. And this comes, just looking at the way we shop can give you an insight into that.
Definitely.
Well, let's go on to the next question, because that's the topic I think we can talk quite a bit about, and we'll probably end up using all the time that we have. What are the most common legal ways to reduce one's tax burden in South Africa? That's an interesting one.
Indeed. You know, and as you correctly mentioned, it's a topic that has no end. It's like we just we can continue going on talking about
yeah.
And never see the end of it. But I must emphasize before I even start talking about anything regarding taxes that I'm not an expert tax practitioner per se or registered practitioner in this context. All that matters is that I've just been exposed to some of these practices, and my role in this whole process is just to highlight some of the legal ways of doing it, because what I see the end of people doing tax minimization or tax burden minimization in an illegal way, and that's why the topic is of relevance to me. But you know, if you look at South Africa, let me start by saying that in South Africa we have the ninth highest tax to GDP ratio. What this means is that the tax to GDP ratio, if I break it down for ordinary consumers, it basically means that the more the nation's GDP increases, the higher the GDP is, the more, the higher the tax should be, right?
Yeah.
But normally in the South African context is that we have very low GDP, but very high tax. So it's kind of like, it's like for a developing country, we pay too much tax and see very little return. And this is what prompts the whole idea of wanting to minimize one's tax burden. Now, what I'll do is, there are a total of about six ways of minimizing one's tax burden. I'm not going to touch on all six of them, because two of them, in my view, are related to the more higher net worth individuals, issues like maybe endowment funds and maybe rebalancing of asset allocation stuff. That's more for the higher net worth individuals. I'm just going to focus on the four which are more within the reach of ordinary citizens and ordinary consumers. The first one I want to touch on is the aspect of retirement funds. Keep in mind that we are allowed to contribute up to 27.5% of your annual income to a pension fund, a provident fund, or even a retirement annuity. And you can deduct that contribution, thereby lowering your tax for the year. So up to 27.5% of your annual income can be contributed towards some kind of pension fund, provident fund, or even a retirement annuity. Now, I must add that when adopting these mechanisms like a pension fund, provident fund, retirement annuity, one must ensure that they are Sharia compliant at least. That's the minimum requirement for a consumer. So together with Sharia compliance, keep in mind that there is this huge tax saving that can be gained through taking out or utilizing these tools for minimizing one's tax burden. Retirement funds, I must add, are not considered part of your estate, and are therefore not subject to estate duty. So in that sense, it's an excellent estate planning vehicle. And RA, from the 3 years I mentioned above, the RA has additional benefits in that you can continue to contribute to the fund even after retirement and thus continue to benefit from the tax deduction. So it's important to keep in mind that together with your retirement benefit, saving towards your retirement, there's also a tax benefit during your working lifetime that you can acquire and gain from in a legitimate way. So that's an important aspect to keep in mind, utilization of retirement planning tools for minimizing one's tax burden. What I forgot to say is that there's also no tax on growth within a retirement fund. So if you invested in a retirement fund and it's a growing investment, there would not be any tax on that. So not having a tax eating away at your investment is a significant effect on the long-term gain that you make on any investment. So that's the first one, utilization of retirement funds to
reduce
the burden. The second one is the aspect of tax-free savings accounts, which are similar to a retirement fund in that there's no tax on the growth within the fund. and you don't pay capital gains tax when you withdraw the funds. But the other significant aspect of tax-free savings account is that it is not governed by what we call Regulation 28 of the Pension Fund Act. Remember that Regulation 28 of the Pension Fund Act is the piece of legislation which moderates how and where funds can be allocated. So what the benefit is that if you have a tax-free savings account, you can basically allocate the total investment offshore if you want to, because there isn't any prescription of how or where the funds are invested. Now, I know from some of the experts are not big fans of tax-free savings accounts. That you can only contribute 33,000 rand a year and a maximum of 500,000 in your lifetime. But it is still a vital component towards saving or minimizing one's tax burden. So that's the second one, the tax-free savings account. Again, once again, I must add, there are Sharia-compliant options, and one should rather exercise those. It is required to exercise those before looking at any other non-approved option of tax-free savings account. So those are two. Can I proceed with the other two?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, the other one, the third one, is the aspect of what is many consumers may have heard about, is the Section 12J investment. It's basically a new business venture that South African Revenue Service has deemed to be beneficial for economic growth. But investing in these ventures, in Section 12J ventures, is a great way to reduce tax, because you are allowed to deduct the total cost of the investment from your income. Now, depending on your tax bracket, you could save up to 45% on the purchase of the investment alone. Now, I think what I must add here, in comparison to the other two that I mentioned in the past, there's a bit of a word of caution on 12J investments, because they are not that attractive from a capital gains tax point of view. So what this means is that when you sell after the compulsory holding period of 5 years, you need to pay capital gains tax on the full value of the investment, not just the gains from the investment. So this could basically, having to pay capital gains tax means that you're offsetting any initial tax savings that you might have made. So you've got to do homework, you've got to check out what the implications would be, and do a cost-benefit analysis in terms of taking out a 12J or putting money in a 12J investment versus selling it off eventually and then having to pay capital gains tax. So that's an important one to keep in mind. And then we also have the aspect of gifts. You know, when I talk of gifts, I'm talking about donations more specifically, many individuals don't realize that in South Africa, each individual taxpayer is allowed to make donations of up to 100,000 rand a year before the 20% donation tax kicks in. So it's a great way to double up on your tax breaks, and to contribute towards maybe a child's tax-free savings account or grandchild's tax-free savings account, or even make any donation to a charitable cause, a Section 18 cause. In this way, if the entity is approved in terms of its Section 18 status, you as a donor can benefit from that and minimize your own tax burden. So these are just four of the common ways. I'll just repeat them very quickly. One is the utilization of retirement funds and planning tools to minimize one's tax burden. The second is the aspect of tax-free savings accounts, 12J investments. Number three, these first three, it is crucial to ensure that they are Sharia-compliant before embarking on them as financial planning tools. And the fourth aspect of or tool or mechanism to minimize one's tax burden is the aspect of donation towards worthy causes, more so when those entities enjoy a Section 18 status.
Okay. All right. Tax is something that I find very difficult to understand. So, it takes me a bit of time to having to ask a lot of questions, read and repeat in order to get an understanding of it. So I'm hoping that if there are any questions with regards to that Mufti is not an expert, as he said, with regards to tax. So that if there are questions, maybe speak to somebody who has expertise in that field. Or maybe if you have a question or two that he could handle, and if you send it to to us, you can do that on 011-854-1548, or you can send me a text message or WhatsApp on 084-030-9955. That's 084-030-9955. Okay, the next one.
No, I think put at ease some of the concerns many individuals have regarding tax affairs. A simple rule is to maintain a financial lifestyle which is less complicated. The less complicated, the better, because the whole topic of tax becomes complicated when the individual's overall financial lifestyle is very complicated. So, it's very true when they say that simplicity is the ultimate form of sophistication. If a person keeps a simple financial life, it is much more easier to manage the tax implications of or tax management side of that individual's lifestyle. So for me, the Islamic values of just maintaining simplicity is the key towards avoiding all this complication when it comes to management of one's affairs. But be it as it may, there are individuals who are wealthy and maybe having a very favorable position from a wealth point of view and, and need expert advice regarding the management of their tax affairs. Most individuals who are in that bracket tend to get their advice, but I think what I've done is hopefully just emphasize on the four key mechanisms for ordinary individuals to minimize their tax burden.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to the next one, and that is Nutella's hazelnuts may reveal something every consumer should be concerned about. I thought the sugar in Nutella is something we should be concerned about, but you say the hazelnuts may reveal something. Tell us more.
Yes. You know, Appa, I must say I was really confused about, because in the recent past I was listening to a radio show, and there was a whole big laugh about how to pronounce the word Nutella. So I had to go onto the website and find out how to pronounce the word. And surprisingly, on the website, FAQ section, they've got a suggested pronunciation of the word Nutella. So that's the first thing I had to do in picking up the story. Nutella's hazelnut does reveal something every consumer should be concerned about, and it is the aspect of their labor practices. I think before I go into the topic itself, allow me to just give some background information here regarding hazelnuts. I found this really staggering and surprising that at least 3/4 of the world's hazelnuts come from Turkey. The biggest buyer is the very famous Italian family-owned company Ferrero. I'm sure that's also a name to many. Ferrero makes the Nutella brand, Kinder chocolates, and many other very tasty chocolate brands that consumers are inclined towards having. But now, 1/3 of that Turkish crop basically goes to Ferrero. Almost 1/3 of the entire Turkish crop goes to Ferrero itself alone.
Wow.
I'm led to believe that the company makes enough Nutella, which is almost equivalent to the Empire State Building, being 365,000 tons. That means 365,000 tons of Nutella is being manufactured by the company. This I found really staggering. It sounds unbelievable, but it seems to have been verified by a few sources and reliable ones. I must add. That's how much of Nutella is being produced by Ferrero. I found it shocking that, and really sad to note that BBC is reporting that the company is not doing enough to manage migrant labor, to manage child exposure to labor, and the usage of children in the procuring of hazelnuts. What that means is basically these vulnerable individuals, migrants, children, are subjected to long, long hours of work and very low wage. That's obviously a concern. I think before I go on to the pertinent points that need to be driven home, I just want to say that, it's for us as ordinary consumers, there are three things to keep in mind. First of all, many a time when you look at these kind of labor practices, malpractices by large corporations that we identify with, on one hand, yes, there's a portion of blame which goes to the companies themselves, but there's also a large portion of blame which goes to governments for failing to regulate the labor industry. Because, and why I say this is because many companies who are engaged in commercial activity, their aim is just to procure goods, take it to market, and produce it the way it needs to be produced.
Yes.
Very seldom do they follow protocol in terms of what the supplier is doing, how are they breaching social practices and so forth before taking the merchandise. They just have to take the merchandise and then produce it, you know. So many a time it's a joint responsibility between these large corporations as well as governments in terms of regulating aspects like migrant labor or even child labor, which is of greater concern to me and should be to every consumer. So that's the one thing. The other aspect is you find that companies like these, they very seldom can you trace the sourcing of merchandise. And the reason for this is that they run the risk of revealing their sources to competitors. So these kind of practices lead to the distortion of the social fabric, and I'm referring to the aspect of how child labor is being used in the process of procuring these hazelnuts, or even the aspect of migrant labor. Just as a result of not being able to reveal your trade secret, you find that it gives rise to other malpractices in society. And this is of concern to me. And the last point I want to make is the aspect of, for us as consumers, when we discover that large corporations like this, whose products tantalize our taste buds, many of us, very seldom do we have the willpower to say no. I will stay away from this because it violates the values of Islam and in general. Very seldom. So many a time you find even boycott campaigns or discovery of these kind of malpractices, they yield very little results in terms of ordinary consumers being able to take a stand and say, you know what, I want to exercise my willpower and I'm staying away from this because I don't like what is happening and I don't agree with it. Fundamentally, it doesn't agree with my value system and therefore I'm staying away.
That's very, very true, I think. I mean, we've seen it within the clothing industry, the, malpractices against children and other minority groups within places like Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, India, Malaysia. And yet we still wear those brands. We still support those brands. And here again, you've told us about this particular product or this particular manufacturing establishment. And due to the fact that we enjoy these things, we don't usually stand up to it and say no.
Yes, definitely. In this case, it's an item, a news item that has been reported on by large entities, verified as fact by news agencies. And so it's not just ordinary news that TLC going around regarding the malpractices of a company. It's verified information that this large corporation is not doing enough to avoid malpractices of child labor and migrant labor and so forth. So I think for me, as you mentioned, it's the whole aspect of ordinary consumers' willpower to say enough is enough. I as much as I enjoy this product, it's all about if you are able to put it aside, it demonstrates an ability to manage your own nafs and your own soul,
which is required
in the Quran and Sunnah.
Absolutely. And I think, when we look at the fact that we support something like the BDS campaign, why are we not supporting this? Because it basically falls into the same kind of category.
Yes. That's the issue. We need to be driven by principle, and this is why we lose respect, because we are not driven by principle in just about all our affairs, not only commercial affairs. Principle is what determines the level of respect we gain in the eyes of other people, not only in the Muslim community, also among our contemporary citizens and our patriots. How do we only gain respect when we are principled in our approaches throughout our lives? So when it comes to this specific aspect of consumer behavior, we need to be very principled and apply the rules consistently.
That we
earn a level of respect and uphold dignity of other individuals.
I totally agree with you on that, but let's move on. We've got a little bit of time left and we can quickly speak about a proper perspective of a retailer's returns policy, an important one to discuss.
Definitely. Well, many consumers believe that if they buy something and with the CPA around, that I'll just have a right to return it, you know, and I'll get a refund. But this is not necessarily the case. So many people believe that they have the right to return anything they bought if it doesn't fit or they change their mind for some reason and that they are entitled to a refund. This is not the case. The reality is that retailers are not legally compelled to take back anything if it is not defective or not fit for purpose in some way. So if you've just decided, you know what, during your lunch hour, someone's decided they're going out, going to buy some clothing and then come back to work on time, you know, only to realize you come back and you bought the wrong size. It doesn't mean that you can just go and return it and get your full refund back. Consumers should know that if the item is it's fine, it's in order, there's nothing wrong with it. It's perfectly, it's fit for use, so to say.
Yeah.
In that case, a retailer is allowed to rely on the returns policy and say that the item is fine, we are not returning it, we are not able to process the refund. You know, it is possible to have that kind of outcome. So consumers shouldn't be disappointed when they go back to a retailer and get this kind of news that a refund cannot be processed. I must add that some of these values are consistent with Islamic principles in the sense that the status of that, the legal, Islamic legal status of the first transaction has to be allocated. So from an Islamic perspective, there was an offer, acceptance, you purchased it willingly. Even from an Islamic perspective, if we have to just keep reversing transactions willingly, there's basically no incentive to carry out trade then, because your consumer has such amount of rights which override everything and anything. So even from an Islamic perspective, if there is no good enough basis to return a transaction or reverse a transaction, a seller is allowed and within their right to maintain their policy of no refund. Obviously, we are encouraged to be lenient and exercise some kind of concession. From a hadith point of view, there is great merit in doing so. In the words of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, is something to this effect, he mentioned that if you overlook the remorse of your customer, Allah Ta'ala will overlook your mistakes on the day of Qiyamah. So there is a level of virtue, but at the same time, it is important to keep in mind that if there is no legitimate grounds, then a seller or retailer is allowed, within their right to stipulate that they will not be able to process a refund.
Okay, that's interesting to know, because I think we have this perception that you can take anything back to a store and accept, you know, just expect a refund just because you want one. You know, sometimes we have the case where I think and I'll speak for myself, we have been dishonest in some cases where you purchase something and you take it back only because maybe, you know, the person you bought it for doesn't fit you. You've used it, but you take it back because you still have the tag on or something like that. And if the store owner decides not to refund it, you don't have the right to actually be angry or upset about it.
Yes, definitely. And it's more so because the item itself is in good working order. It's perfectly fine. Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you bring back an appliance and maybe say there's a problem, it's not working. In that case, there's a refund, replace, or repair kind of approach taken. And that's within the CPA as well as consistent with some of the Islamic laws. But in the case where there's nothing wrong with the merchandise, a consumer has to be ready to know that the retailer is not willing to refund the merchandise or refund the purchase price.
All right, that's quite interesting to know, and I think something that we should keep in mind the next time you decide to go for a refund. Well, that's the end of today's show for us, and inshallah we'll be speaking to you again next week to get more empowered and educated with all the lovely knowledge that you impart to us, alhamdulillah. And jazakallah khair for this morning, and we'll talk to you again next week, inshallah.
Alhamdulillah, it has been a pleasure. Yeah, I look forward to another program, inshallah. Jazakallah khair.
Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.